Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Rosslare podcast. Today we listen in to Mick Wallace and Claire Daly as they're interviewed on the American podcast Around the Empire.
Today we have special guests. We talk to the Irish members of the European Parliament, Claire Daly and Mick Wallace, who are now some of the most powerful anti-war voices heard around the world. We discuss the war in Ukraine, sanctions, flooding this war with more arms, and how all of these things lead to more war and destruction and not peace.
This war is empowering all the worst elements everywhere, in Russia, in Ukraine, and in NATO countries. The vices of barbarism are drowning out the vices for peace. The arms industry, the fossil fuel industry, the warmongers and war-lending polluters are presented by the media as the sane people, the reasonable ones. We just had the publication of the IPCC's sixth assessment report. It's telling us that we're looking at the last chance to act to save human life on Earth. The window of opportunity is closing for good. And what are the reasonable people, the grown-ups, doing? They're funneling weapons into a hot war like there's no tomorrow, implementing sanctions that are cleaving the world into new shapes that will set back the possibility to achieve meaningful climate action for decades, while basic supply chain disruptions are going to cause prolonged suffering and destabilisation all over Eurasia and in Europe. We are being led by people who are prepared to see the world destroyed. It is insufferable.
Grazie, Presidente. So, the EU solution to the war in Ukraine is more war. Pile in the weapons, splurge on militarism, threaten to engage in all-out economic and financial war against Russia. So the same things you were doing already and expecting a different result, the true definition of madness. How is not selling Kerrygold butter to Russia going to save any Ukrainian lives? How is buying filthy, fracked US gas going to stop the war? They won't, of course, because nowhere have sanctions ever succeeded in ending a military assault or achieving regime change. But what they have done is unleash economic devastation, this time round, which will be paid for by the people of Russia, including those out protesting against the war, and increasingly being paid for by the citizens of Europe, facing massive energy price hikes, inflation, and a catastrophic decline in their living standards. Talk about shooting ourselves in the foot. And of course, this moral outrage at Russia's illegal war, which has sparked this lunacy, is in sharp contrast to the lack of any such scruples in terms of the illegal US wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, which we not only didn't condemn, but we actually joined in and continue to do business with them all the way. No such scruples about Saudi Arabia's genocide in Yemen. And even as the victims of those conflicts in the last few weeks meet to desperately seek financial pledges for their humanitarian crisis, they're being left short by billions, while we're happy to spend billions prolonging the war in Ukraine. Makes me absolutely sick. 7 weeks ago, German Chancellor Scholz correctly said, "Peace in Europe cannot be won against Russia." But that's exactly what we're doing. Yes, Russia bears responsibility for this conflict. Of course they do. But we cannot ignore the role of NATO. And the EU, instead of promoting peace and acting in the interests of the people of Europe, the Ukrainians, the EU citizens, and yes, the Russian citizens too, has become a tool of NATO and the military-industrial complex. What is needed is an end to the conflict, an end to militarism, a ceasefire, and a negotiated settlement. We should restore our role as a diplomatic one of promoting peace. Anything else makes us complicit. I would love colleague Jambaski to tell me any circumstance in which NATO has played a productive role or delivered peace anywhere. History has taught us that sanctions do not end military conflict. They do not bring peace. They make the people suffer, not the oligarchs, the people of Russia, the people of Europe. And they're not going to help save lives, because the more arms you pump into Ukraine, the more the war will be prolonged, the more Ukrainians will die. And it might sound radical, colleagues, but the answer to war is not more war, it's peace. And peace isn't delivered by the barrel of a gun. It's delivered by diplomacy, by dialogue. You can wish away your continent's history, but we share a continent with Russia. We will sit down with Russia. There will be a negotiated peace, and this organization should be promoting it earlier rather than delaying it and making sure that more Ukrainians die. Your feigning of sympathy rings hollow. It makes me sick, to be honest with you.
Welcome to Around the Empire. I'm your host, Joanne Leon. Kelly Lane is here co-hosting, and we have some really special guests today. Speaking to us from Belgium, we have Mick Wallace and Claire Daly. And thank you so much. It's so great to meet you, and it's so much fun to have you on the show. And not just fun, it's really important. You're really important voices in the imperial world. And frankly, you're going kind of viral among the independent anti-imperial in media over here. I don't know if you know that or not, but you are. And of course, it's mostly the video of you, Claire, in Parliament talking about, you know, this whole mess of a war in Ukraine and NATO escalation and how arming more people is not going to help anything. I don't know, maybe you want to just say a few things about yourself before we get started. I kind of jumped into that a little bit prematurely.
Well, I mean, we're both Irish members of the European Parliament. We're independent, but we are obviously lefty types as well, but we're not in a political party prior to being elected to the European Parliament. So we are 2 out of 13 members of the European Parliament from Ireland. Prior to that, we were in the Irish Parliament for 8 years. So, you know, anything else you'd say about us?
We're always in trouble.
Yeah, we are always. And we're especially in trouble at the moment now because your characterization of our approach on the war, while you're right, we've got the attention of a lot of people around the world on this. Sadly, that's because the sky is so dark that there are so few voices speaking out against the sort of mammoths. One single view of this war that when somebody says anything even slightly different, it kind of grabs the headlines. But you can be guaranteed that the manner in which it's been portrayed at home in Ireland is far from favourable. We are a disgrace and an embarrassment. The country are utterly ashamed of us, allegedly, and they cannot wait until the next election when we will be no more, or so the establishment tell us.
Yeah, that was what I was going to start out with here in my notes. I was going to say that one of the biggest reasons we wanted to talk to you is that for whatever reason, this is a rare position to be able to hold a position opposing an invasion of Ukraine, but also, you know, recognizing that the NATO expansion and a lot of other things provoked it and, you know, opposing flooding Ukraine with arms. For numerous reasons. And I noticed that in an article on the Irish Times about you, it says that there was an Irish anti-war protest recently, and it said both NATO and Russia should keep hands off Ukraine. You know, it's so hard to find this position. It does, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, there's just some crazy things going on. Both Kelly and I kind of identify as independent now, too. We've totally fed up with the political parties and such, though we tend to take a left leaning. I take a sort of libertarian leaning on some positions, too. But so anyway, like, why is this? To me, that's a perfectly rational position to take. But you are really apparently required to take a side. And there's no nuance to this. Why is that? It's the same way in Europe, because it's that way here too.
Yeah, look at, I suppose what's been happening for the last 6 weeks, there's been a very black and white take on it. I suppose being members of the European Parliament, we're very conscious of the fact that for at least 3 months leading up to the invasion, the rhetoric was very disappointing in the Parliament, in the Commission, into council. I don't know if you know how the European Parliament actually really works. There's really three, there's three parts to it. You have the Parliament, which consists of the elected members. But then you have the Commission, which initiates legislation. And then you have the Council, which is made up of member states, right? And the Commission would be seen as the more powerful of the three. The Parliament, definitely the weaker of the three. There'll be a serious shortage of democracy in the European institutions anyway. But the Council will probably be the stronger element when it comes to foreign affairs matters. And the Council meetings are held in secret. There's no transparency around them. But it's pretty obvious for a long time that the US, NATO have probably more of a stranglehold on the decision-making in Europe than before. We would argue that, I mean, the European Union, the European Parliament, for example, works in 5-year stints. I mean, so there was elections, for example, in 2019, and the people will stay here till 2024. We would say that right now, the European Union has probably never been as weak before. It has never shown such a lack of independence. And a real big problem that we would find that led to the war actually not being stopped was the disappearance of Merkel. If Merkel, I mean, obviously we wouldn't be a fan of her politics, but she was very strong. And we don't think she would actually have allowed the war to take place, because the war was allowed to happen. And it was allowed to happen for no good reason, probably driven more by the military-industrial complex, of which NATO serves morning, noon and night. And unfortunately, there wasn't many adults in the room. France and Germany played a decent role in trying to prevent the war breaking out. Schulz obviously was found to be too inexperienced and not near as strong as Merkel. And I don't think Macron and Schulz between them, they weren't able to bring US NATO along with them, and the war was allowed to happen. It doesn't excuse what Putin has done. It doesn't make any excuse for the war. We think that Putin was totally wrong to invade. And we like to think that he had other options to fight, despite the fact that he was been bet into a corner. But the refusal by the European Union to respect the fact that Russia has genuine security concerns about the idea of NATO going into Ukraine was really disappointing on the part of the European Union. I mean, we know that if NATO had gone into Ukraine, it would have been possible to put missiles on the Ukraine-Russian border that would have hit the populated area of Russia, where 80% of the population live, including Moscow. It would have been possible to hit Moscow within 5 minutes with a missile. And they haven't invented the missile defense systems to cater for that, to deal with that. So the idea of NATO going into Ukraine was a complete no-no for Russia, definitely a no-no for Putin. This war was allowed to happen. And as I said, it doesn't change the fact that Putin is out of order invading the place. But from our perspective, as members of the European Parliament, we're obviously gutted that Europe didn't do more to stop it. We're gutted about the fact that they have done bugger all to work towards developing peace, getting negotiations going, because sometimes negotiations will happen. And in the meantime, Ukrainians are losing their lives. But you know what? It's like as if some people are pretty happy enough for the war to go on for another while, despite the fact that it is costing Ukrainian lives. Mm.
You know, before we, I wanted to say something about the elections, as you were saying, Joanne. I think it's very interesting, you know, that your videos, the clips we've seen have really gone viral over here, especially among independent left, I guess, But I really, you know, the people, other people in the room have this look of like, who let these two in, you know, like the establishment does have, they do have this grip. I know over here for sure on our election system and the way things are gerrymandered and who knows with the voting machines. And it's just interesting that, you know, I think your voices and what you're saying, really, it's rare that they do have, you know, an audience on the international stage. But when they do, they really resonate with people across political spectrums. And I just, yeah, I just wanted to point that out that, yeah, it, there's a reason. It's because a lot of people are feeling what you're saying.
And I think you created a space for that narrative where you can hold two positions on this. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No, not at all. I mean, it is striking. And I mean, we have been really struck by the scale of the response globally. So not just from the States, but like from all across Europe, from Germany, from Italy, from Africa, from Ireland, people everywhere saying, do you know what? You're actually saying what I was thinking, but I'm kind of afraid to say it because if I actually say that, somebody's going to say what they're saying to us. Oh, you're Putin's whore. You're on the payroll of Moscow. I mean, the vitriol that we have been subjected to for if we had gone in and said, hooray for Putin, go in and kill a few more Ukrainians, we couldn't be getting as much abuse, even though we have roundly condemned the invasion. And all we've done is argue for peace. But by that, we're being the ones characterized as basically arguing for or nearly causing the slaughter of Ukrainians when in actual fact, the continuation of the war does that. So I think a lot of people out there are confused because the one narrative that they're getting is contradicting their own beliefs when they actually think about it. And the mainstream media just wants us to see that you're either for us or you're against us. And if you say anything at all that goes against the narrative, well, then you're a Putin puppet or at best a sort of a gullible Egypt that they're using. And we've had all that. And it's really quite disgusting because it's to delegitimize an anti-war view. So we're just too stupid or we're too much in the payroll without actually listening to what we're saying. And what we're saying is that sanctions have never ended a war, that pouring more arms into a conflict have never ended a war. All that ends a war is negotiation. And that, and people say, so you want to do nothing? You want Russia to win? But diplomacy and dialogue is not doing nothing. It's bloody hard work. And we know that from an Irish point of view, from the peace process. And actually, the US played a good role in that. But we needed the international community to get behind those issues and support Ireland and the UK in struggling to get a peace agreement, and they got it. And we need something similar here, you know, but that's heresy now. It shall not be tolerated.
Yeah.
Well, we've dealt with that here in the US for the past, what, at least 5-6 years now, because the polarization is just so extreme. And the media, I mean, they fuel it, and you're either one side or the other. And you really have to repeat often. I mean, for us, it was always, I'm not for Trump, but, you know, I'm not for this either. So it's a constant battle, and they want to shove you. Even regular people kind of don't know what to, some don't know what to do with you when you don't fit in one side or the other. Mm. So I just applaud you guys for speaking out. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the point should be made, though, that, you know, if you're to kind of think that Twitter was the real world, or if you thought that the mainstream media just told the truth all the time, you know, you'd be living in cuckoo land, right? Because that's not the way it is, right? And there's an awful lot of just genuine people out there who actually have a different take on things, but they don't express it, or they don't have a voice. But people get the idea that, oh, if the mainstream media are saying it, well, that must be the way it is then. But people don't really... The ordinary people of Ireland, for example, don't see it all the time like the mainstream media does. I mean, we wouldn't have been elected if that was the case. I mean, we were saying the same things for 8.5 years in the Irish Parliament. We both got elected to the Irish Parliament in 2011. We both got re-elected in 2016. We both stood in the European elections in 2019. And people said, well, oh, they won't get in. And the media... you know, a lot of them wouldn't have wanted us to get in, but and despite getting no positive publicity, we got amazing support from the Irish people who saw through a lot of the mainstream media bullshit.
This is where we diverge, though, because I actually think that if there was an election now, and Mick disagrees with me, that we wouldn't get elected now, because such is the hatchet job that has been done on us in terms of demonising us at home. I mean, he's absolutely right. We're not saying anything different than we hadn't said when we were in the Irish Parliament, but it wasn't treated with the same hysteria as our comments are being treated now. And like, just, you know, the amount of people are getting, you refuse to condemn the Russian invasion. No, we didn't. You know what I mean? You're just, you know, supporting Putin. No, we're not. You know what I mean? And when people repeat that often and often, it does. And what's a really new thing they're using, which is a bit disgusting, is that we're an embarrassment and a disgrace. Now, this is a bit amusing, because what they're actually saying is there has to be one truth. There is only one truth, and you can't have a difference of opinion in terms of how we might end the war. So anybody who goes off the official narrative is a heretic. That's really scary, like, you know. And when we say that to people, they'd say, you know, well, look, I have a right to disagree. Oh, lucky you. You've the right to disagree. Sitting in your comfortable home, you're not being bombed in Ukraine. You'd say, yes, I am lucky. That's what democracy is supposed to be, the right to have a different opinion. So I'm going to use that right. You think I should give it up? Like, and we just have one view, but it's this mad stuff going on.
But back in 2002, 2003, before the Iraq war started, you will remember that it was Bush that time that came up with the slogan, you're either with us or against us. Mm. And that was actually used by the Irish Prime Minister at the time, the Taoiseach, who was Bertie Ahern at the time. And when the debate started in the Irish Parliament, it's called the Dáil in Irish, about whether Ireland would allow Shannon Airport to be used by the US military to bomb Iraq back to the Stone Age. The argument was used by the Prime Minister in the Parliament. Come on, you're either with us or against us. Mm. You know, so that notion is nothing new. It's been around for a while. But I mean, painting things in black and white is not good, because life isn't black and white, and it's a lot more complex than that. And it's very complex trying to stop a war too, and it isn't going to be easily stopped, but you have to want to stop it. And at the moment, there isn't enough of the powerful people, the so-called adults in the room, who want to stop the war. I mean, what has the EU done to stop the war? All the talk is about, you would think that we were a military entity, that we were a military alliance. We're actually not. The EU was built as a peace project so that the Europeans would stop fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. And it was a peace project for a long time. But we have noticed for the last number of years that the increased militarization of Europe and the amount of influence that the military industrial complex has over the EU institutions has increased dramatically. And that's not disconnected to what's happening today. But likewise, I mean, just supposing Biden wanted the war to stop as soon as possible. Could he do something about it? I reckon he could, right? Now, unfortunately, I actually think that neither Russia or Ukraine want to stop right now either. Both of them want to get into a better position for negotiation. And that's unfortunate, because there's innocent people dying. But the so-called adults in the room are not making any genuine effort to work towards peace at the moment. And that's scary. And we don't have the mainstream media calling them out. The mainstream media is not batting for peace. The mainstream media is taking a black and white look at it. There's just goodies and baddies. And the amount of rhetoric around, this is different from Iraq, this is different from Syria, this is different from Yemen, this is different from Afghanistan, where US and sanctions from parts of Europe at the moment today are starving people to death. According to the UN, up to 1 million people could die of hunger in Afghanistan. And we're doing bugger all about it. Oh, no, we don't want to talk about that. And they say about the Ukrainians, oh, but they even looked like us, right? They're white and they're Christian, and they're acceptable. And whereas our treatment of refugees from the countries that I just named, that we helped to destroy, we are building walls to prevent them out. We're pushing them back into the Mediterranean to drown. Mm. right? But now, but we care about refugees from Ukraine. Listen, I'm glad we do. As we should care for anyone fleeing from a war situation. But it's a pity that we didn't care and still don't care about the people coming from those countries like Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, and Libya, where we helped to destroy their communities. In Ireland, we allowed Shannon Airport to be used by the US military to destroy their communities and homes. And now we don't even want them to come in, but it's different with Ukraine. Mm. It's shocking, and it's really worrying from our perspective that that the so-called decision makers in the European Union have got to this space, but we would say that they have probably never, the decision makers or the so-called decision makers in our perspective have never been as weak. They have never shown such a lack of independence, and they now appear to be a total servant of the US NATO entity. Mm.
The ground has been well prepared for it, I think. You know, NATO think tanks predominate all across Europe, funding a lot of the mainstream media as well. So now you have kind of on point, the narrative is the same, like Ukrainians need arms. They have to defend themselves. Putin's a madman. You know, all of the, it's the same message that's gone out, simplifying the whole thing, you know.
You know, it seems like there's a different factor. I completely agree with the amount of power that the military industrial complex has and NATO. And the explanation that, you know, Merkel was the one sort of keeping this under wraps as best she could. And as soon as she was gone, it was kind of unleashed. But it does seem like there's another factor here related to the financial system, the petrodollar, the potential collapse, some competition between the central banks, even the in the US and Europe, which I don't understand it well enough myself. I just wondered if you saw something different this time that was an additional factor that caused the European countries to put up so little resistance to this.
Well, I mean, you're right in the sense that there's, look, at the American dollar has been supreme since 1944, from the time of Bretton Woods, when the dollar became the world's number one currency. It was linked to gold, and they broke the link in 71 when the Fed told Nixon that they had printed three times more dollars than they had gold to match. And it has been a huge weapon. It's been weaponized. The power of the dollar has been weaponized in the last number of years. And it is hugely problematic. But if you, I wouldn't accept that it was a driving force with the war. For example, I actually think, first of all, they're going to drive Russia closer to China. We always insist that there isn't just anti-Russian rhetoric in the European Parliament. There's a lot of anti-Chinese rhetoric, which was even more loud than the anti-Russian until the war started, because Russia is seen, or China is seen, as a much bigger threat to the Americans. Now, China is not a threat to the security of the American state or the American people, but China is a threat to the supremacy of the dollar. So it's a threat to the US financial supremacy in the world. And that's a big factor. And the US has been making strenuous efforts to drive a wedge between, not just between Europe and Russia, but more, even more so, between Russia and China. But I would say that the days of the dollar being the supreme currency, the single number one currency, are closer now than they were before. And because I'm not saying the dollar, that there's a currency going to replace it, there isn't, but you're going to have a few currencies. And obviously, the renminbi is going to become as equally powerful as the dollar in a number of years. The Chinese will be the largest economy on the planet, I'd say, within 10 or 15 years. And they're a serious player. And I think that Russia, there's a new Cold War coming. There's a Cold Wall going to be built, which isn't in the interest of the people of Europe or of Russia. And sadly, it will cause the deterioration of European relations with much of Asia, because much of them will actually end up in the Russia-China camp. But I mean, listen, we should be developing good relations with everybody, everybody, not picking fights and picking sides. Right? It isn't in the interest of the citizens of Europe to be fallen out with any of these countries. But it probably is in the interest of big finance in the US for us to have a less healthy relationship with China. China is our biggest trading partner. Now, just the same as if Putin were to turn off the oil in the morning, the German economy would be devastated. God knows how many hundreds of thousands would be laid off. Supposing the Chinese stop buying cars from the Germans. The Chinese buy more cars from Germany than anybody else. Now, supposing they stop buying, what happens? It isn't going to be good for the people of Europe. It doesn't make any sense. We're becoming, we always say that the European Union was the concept was a good one, but it's losing its way. It is now, with the militarization and with the prioritization of the interest of big business over those of the ordinary people, we would say now that the European Union has developed into a neoliberal right-wing club. And that was kind of enshrined with the big treaty changes in Nice and Lisbon. And it's really worrying because we want the European Union to work. We're described as Eurosceptics. Well, what we're skeptical of is it going in the wrong direction. We want it to grow in the right direction. And we didn't come over, get elected, stand for election for the European Parliament to come over here and kiss its arse. But we didn't come over to burn it either. But we want it to work. But sadly, we feel that it's got serious problems, and we'd be very worried about its future at the moment.
Yeah, it's totally captured, really, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's so demonstrably not in Europe's interest to take the stance it's taken. Yet not only are they taking it, but they're even going further. So all of the talk about sanctions, more sanctions, not trading in oil, coal, blocking gas, unreal. As Mick says, we could be talking about catastrophic declines in European living standards if this keeps going the way it's going. Yet that's the space they're moving into. It's just like collective lunacy. And obviously it's really good news for the likes of, you know, American fracked gas getting it back into Europe, which, you know, has been long sought but had been blocked because of the climate emergency. But even all of the measures that they're now ditching in terms of the bare minimum standards that were necessary to save the planet and in tackling climate change are being thrown out the window now under the guise of the war. It's quite frightening. We find that it's scary.
We had a very good debate with the Commission. I'm on the Environment Committee as well last week on the Environment, or the week before. And the Commission admitted that, we have big agri who have always pushed back, been pushing back against environmental measures because it was seen as financially problematic for them. And they didn't want to go to the space of where we would deal in a healthy fashion with the problems of climate change. And in fairness, the European Union did well to get the new Green Deal in place. But there's huge pushback now against the Green Deal, and not just from Big Agri, but Big Agri are at the driving force of it. And they're actually making out that, oh, in the interest of food security, we may park all these new measures. And the Green Deal is not for today now. We've other problems. We've bigger fish to fry. We have more pressing problems. But in actual fact, we haven't. Why? The environment is an incredibly pressing problem. And they're underestimating the threat of climate change. And the idea that they would use this war now to undermine the Green Deal is really dangerous. But they're saying that we're in the interest of food security, we're going to be short of food. Well, in actual fact, we're not. We're still going to export grain in the next 12 months. We're not going to be short of food. But what the problem will be is the price is going to go up through the heavens. And a whole lot of the less well-off households are going to struggle with their bills. And there's going to be social measures required in order for people to survive and to be able to feed their families. Because we're introducing sanctions that are not designed to stop the war, but are designed to cripple the Russian economy. And we're introducing sanctions that are going to hurt the ordinary people of Russia the most. And then they'll also hurt the ordinary people of Europe. They won't be hurting Putin. And it won't be hurting anyone else in the Kremlin or any of the oligarchs. Ordinary people will suffer most from the sanctions. But the European Union is prepared to implement sanctions that will hurt their own people. Mm. And they are obviously not too worried about hurting the ordinary people of Europe. But listen, you only have to look at the sanctions in Afghanistan, in Iran, in Syria. All those sanctions, and Venezuela, they hurt the ordinary people. And they're illegal unless sanctioned by the UN. And these are not sanctioned by the UN either. I mean, people have forgot. They don't want to talk about the UN Charter anymore. We had a Bible for international law called the UN Charter, right, for many years. But no, that's gone now because they break it morning, noon and night. Now what we have is the international rules-based order. And that's something they make up as to go along. But it isn't the UN Charter. And unfortunately, the UN is not as strong as it should be. It's not as independent as it should be. But you know what? We believe in international law. We want it to be a lot stronger. We don't agree with war. We think peace is the way forward. We don't think spending money on more and more money on arms. Like, I mean, we have a situation now where Germany is going to spend an extra 100 billion a year on arms. Where's the logic of it? We've housing crisis in Europe. We've ordinary people struggling to afford medical care. We've huge problems with the environment. We've problems with public transport. Why, we want to spend more money on arms? Mm. Are we well?
You're becoming more American.
Sadly, yes. The Atlanticist European Union. Yeah, no. It's totally.
I would love to ask you guys both about, so there was another big voice in the UN, Nils Melzer. One of the other shows I work on behind the scenes is Assange Countdown to Freedom, and he was a regular guest on there with Randy Credico. I wondered if you wanted to speak on that at all, because I think, you know, most of us know at this point that the reason that Assange has been locked away and shut up is because he exposed things that were going on in these wars. And he was a hero of the left when it was the Bush wars. And now that's not the case. But I wondered if you wanted to say anything.
Yeah, I mean, we've been involved in Julian's case since our time in the Irish Parliament. We went to visit him when we were members of the Irish Parliament in the embassy in London. Oh, he'd only been there a year at that stage, I think. When we came to the Parliament first here, we had a big meeting, one of the most successful. Obviously, the Parliament kind of shut down then with COVID 2 years later. But we had Nils Melzer over at a very big meeting here in the Parliament that we hosted. Julian's dad, John Shipton, attended it as well. Bob Hawke, the former Australian Prime Minister or leader of the Labour Party, was also at it. So it was a really high level event, I suppose, about the total injustice of the fact of Julian being incarcerated under the Espionage Act for journalism. And here we have a European Union that waffles on morning, noon and night about freedom of the press and all this kind of great stuff, and they have done nothing. I mean, we have had reports published here where we've tried to get Julian's case mentioned in it, and it's been voted down. Just really, really crazy stuff. You know, it's a cause. There's a very active campaign here in Brussels to free Julian. We've been involved. We've been at the trial in the UK and the appeal. And it's a total travesty. The idea that he would be extradited, as you say, his work was unsurpassed. I mean, this was the sad ironies before our time here in the heydays when he was the hero. Some of the right-wing groups had actually invited him here, and he was a celebrity in those days. And then they all kind of drop him, you know. It's truly frightening. But his work and the work of WikiLeaks, I mean, in shedding the light on the horrors of war, has been really unparalleled. And it's a voice that we need now. And it's tragedy that his life is ruined now, no matter what happens to him. and already the chilling effect of his prosecution. You know, people say if he's extradited, there'll be a chilling effect. The chilling effect is already here. They've already succeeded in gagging people and silencing them. And I think the present narrative around the war is actually part of that gagging as well. I mean, who wants to raise their head and give an anti-war speech now when you're going to be the subject of absolute vitriol and demonization and all the rest, you know?
You mentioned Niels Nelson, right? He's such an impressive guy. He's been brilliant. Mm. And when he came over to speak at the conference that we organized, he was awesome. Mm. It was so good to listen to him. Mm. And he was in the room with us and all, and he was great. But the silence from the people who say that they like press freedom and freedom of speech and they're pro-democracy and they're pro-free journalism, the silence from them on the Assange issue so exposes them. And the silence of the mainstream media about Assange is scary. It's hard to believe that, I mean, just think about it. I mean, if you're a journalist, right? I mean, you want the right to work, and you want the right to work without fear of persecution. And here is a journalist being persecuted. He's been locked up for over 10 years. And journalists themselves are refusing to stand by him. What is it telling us when the journalists of mainstream media are not prepared to stand by Julian Assange, not prepared to call the truth, not to actually, not prepared to address the fact that here's a journalist that's rotting in prison for telling the truth and exposing war crimes committed by US NATO. He exposed our war crimes and he's paying this price for it, and our media are silent. So what does that tell us about the media?
Yeah, I mean, and it's so bad because like his journalism was being carried out in Europe, and yet Europe is sitting silently by. And I think one of the shocking things, we had a report recently, they have a committee here on foreign interference in the democratic processes of the European Union. That's a special committee. And it's actually just an excuse for Russophobia and anti-Chinese rhetoric, because that's all they go on about. And our response has been, do Russia and China engage in disinformation? Yep, they sure do, just like everybody else does. Like, it's called propaganda, promoting your own side. But one of the sections of the report that the committee had a point in it condemning a case in China of two Danish, a little bit similar to Julian's case, but these Danish reporters who are in prison in China, and condemning that and calling for them to be released. So we left that in the report, didn't take it out, but included, and also the case of, in, you know, US extradition, blah, 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 Julian Assange. No, they voted that down. They wouldn't include that. That's how enslaved they are now to the US influence. It's embarrassing, actually. And yet they go on about European autonomy, but as Mick said earlier, they've never been weaker.
We were talking about press freedom. I mean, we find that all news outlets give their own take on stuff, and finding one that is 100% independent would be very difficult. But there was a vote here on banning Russia Today, and we voted against it. So I was asked on Irish media, I said, why did you vote against banning Russia Today? I said, I don't believe in censorship, but they put out propaganda. I said, yeah. And so who doesn't? I said, RTE, the Irish station. I said, they wheel in the Fianna Fáil guys morning, noon and night to give us the US imperialism line. So that's the same thing, I said, only the other side of it. Mm.
Well, it's funny because you were going on about my speech in the Parliament last week, and that appeared on Russian television. Well, I might as well have gone out and shot a few Ukrainians as a result, because the whole thing was this absolute use, you know, willing idiot has given, you know, Russia this. They're playing her speech on television, my God. But like in my speech, I actually condemned the Russian invasion. Now, did the Russian television play that bit? Probably not. But the Irish radio coverage who featured didn't play that bit either, so they sort of censored my view when they were playing it, and then they condemn Russia for doing the same thing. Like, you know, it's just pathetic.
Well, over here it's been so many, like, we had an American journalist, Chris Hedges, Lee Camp, that's more some comedy, but you know, they're they're not pro-Russian. They're just allowed to be critical of the U.S. And I think it has been problematic that those shows were on RT, because for people that believe the propaganda on this side, they might not even listen to it. So I do wish that all of those people could get on a truly independent network, as you said, Mick, but that's just so hard to find, and who's going to fund it. And but that's not to say there isn't pro-Russian propaganda on RT, but it didn't come from those people, Afshin Ratanzi and George Galloway and the American people that were on there. They were just even, oh my goodness, Ed Schultz, he was on MSNBC and basically wasn't allowed to cover things with the Bernie campaign, and he ended up on RT. He wasn't pro-Russian. He just wanted to have the freedom to speak out. So, yeah, that's really...
I think you're right. And that's the key thing about... That was the key role, I think, played by Russia Today, because the most times I was on it was over Julian's case, actually. And I never got an easy ride. Like, they played devil's advocate. They gave you a grilling. You had to defend your position. They didn't just say, oh, Julian is great or anything. You know, it was a rigorous interview. But it's the topics that they covered were the issues that were never given an airing on the mainstream. And that was because they were subject to broadcasting standards as well. And they were never done for breaking the broadcasting rules on any of their coverage, you know.
But it's... Claire was talking earlier about this thing that there's only one truth, right? I mean, that's a dangerous narrative. Mm-hmm. And like, for example, when we've been pushing for peace, we've been pushing for negotiations, and we're accused of being Putin lovers. Now, the media have gone back over stuff that we've said in the last 10 years, stuff that we've said on podcasts, in interviews, and in the parliaments, the Irish or the European. They're going through stuff and checking to see what we've said. You know what? If we had ever said anything good about Putin in the last 10 years, we'd have been hearing it back by now. They could not find one goddamn thing good that we said about Putin in the last 10 years. Putin is a right-wing neoliberal nationalist, right? And none of them attract us a whole lot, right? And we condemn neoliberalism everywhere, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in America or whether it's in Russia or China or wherever it is. And we always insist that we've yet to find a government we like. Yeah. We haven't seen a government we like yet. Yeah. Not even in Ireland.
Oh, especially not in Ireland.
Yeah. Well, I hope your election systems are good and you are allowed to have the people speak and re-elect you again.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, by the way, we have some friends who also write for RT and Sputnik. And like, we know them. We knew them before they started working there. So it's kind of hard to sell us on the whole, you know, idea that it's 100% anti-American or anti-Western propaganda. And I'm not sure how much more time you have, but I do have one bonus question for you that...
Sure.
But I want to make sure that you are able to say, you know, maybe I'm forgetting a topic, or maybe there's some things that you'd like to bring up, and please do.
That's a hard question.
That's the hardest question today.
Yeah, that is the hardest question. I can, at this hour of the day, now I can't. I don't know.
I mean, listen.
You don't have to. We can move on to this.
Okay. No, I suppose. A real worrying thing is that our notion of democracy is almost fictional at this stage. It doesn't really exist. Even in countries where you get to vote every 5 years, people don't really have much of a say in how their community is run, how their society is organized, how their country is run. And despite the fact that they have a vote, the people that are elected, obviously the mainstream media are able to play a strong role and they have a big input into who actually gets elected. And then you have to find that about 65% of the people vote, generally speaking, so one third don't. And most of them, because they're disenfranchised, they wouldn't be voting for the right-wing parties if they were voting, but they don't think it's worth their while because they think that nothing is changing and that they're not represented anyway. Now, I mean, obviously, America probably is the worst example in the sense that you have to be, you need 2 billion to become president of America, and you're not really going to get there without the help of the arms industry, big pharma, oil, coal, you name it. So, I mean, in actual fact, the people that end up being elected don't actually represent the citizens, because the citizens didn't really put them there. They were put there by big business, and they represent big business. And in fairness to them, they don't let big business down. And they look after the interests of big business morning, noon and night. And that's one of the reasons that you spend nearly $800 billion now on arms every year, because the people who actually make the money out of the arms are some of the people who actually put the decision makers in there in the first place. And it is interesting when you're talking about money spent on arms. Mm. The Russians spend $65 billion a year. Americans, $780 billion. Europe is spending 3 times more than the Russians of late. And it's going to go much higher. In fact, the Germans alone are going to spend more next year above their normal budget than the Russians will spend. Mm. I mean, just the extra German money is going to be more than that Russia would spend itself. I mean, but look, just to go back to the point about I'd be fearful about where we're going when the decision makers are not representing the interest of the ordinary citizens. It was never perfect, but it used to be better.
Mm. Yeah, the West has kind of let everyone down, I think. I mean, for me, these are frightening times, like, you know, and I mean, when you think about it, the majority of the world's population lives in countries which actually don't have the narrative that we're being exposed to in terms of this war. And in the States and in Australia, it's very much the white Western world that's categorizing the war in the manner in which we've been discussing here earlier. But the majority of the world's population actually have their own problems, their own issues. They've been at the receiving end of other wars and instability. So they have a different view. And I think that view and sort of that internationalism is something that we have to fight for a lot more as well, you know, because to me, in part, that's where the solution is going to come from.
I agree.
There was some people in the European Union giving out about the lack of support from Africa at the UN on the vote, because loads of them abstained, right? And one of the Africans I saw replying back, have you forgotten about colonialism? Mm. Which hasn't stopped either. It just has new names now. Mm. But there's obviously huge interest in Africa here because of the wealth in the ground. And because of the fact that we still want to exploit it, and we don't have a problem with the fact that our policies down there are still keeping 70% of the people living in poverty. But anyways,
yeah, and I think on the positive, because no, you're right. And I mean, on this internationalism, and it has been reflected, and I suppose it's bringing us back to where we started, the response to our work here in an institution which is largely irrelevant in terms of it, the power that it has, it's practically nil. We've got responses from all over the world, from every continent, from different people all over saying the same thing, that their views are not being represented in their country. And I suppose that gives you cause for hope or despair. I don't know. We haven't found a way of organizing those views or getting those voices heard, but they're out there, which is a good start. So I suppose our job is to, how do we marshal that? How do we connect internationally? I suppose we do it like the way we're doing it, talking now, listening, dialogue, differences of opinion and debate, you know, a rational debate. And that's what we're losing, you know, but that's the start, I suppose, of a new world order. If we have the time to save it from itself.
I think you're right in just knowing that the other people are out there making the connections. It might not seem like a lot, but it might be the key thing to moving forward. Now, you know, it's up to us to take it from here. I think maybe it's time to wrap it up. I don't want to take too much more of your time. And I was wondering, I'm not sure that how many people really understand Ireland's position of neutrality and what it takes to defend that, which I know that you fiercely defend it as, and maybe you want to tell us too about your most recent
adventure in doing that, which, you know, got you in a lot of trouble. But if you wouldn't mind, approach that any way you like.
It's so important that that people don't lose hope, and that people just continue to have the courage to speak the truth, and irrespective of how difficult it can be sometimes, because it's so important.
Right, and then you would
be surprised. Yeah, no, I was just going to say you'd be surprised how many people actually agree with you, even if they're not saying it, but you saying it helps them, you know.
Right. And then that person will speak up when they wouldn't have before. So, and then on and on it goes. So, yeah, I mean, I just keep talking. We're listening.
And like Julian said,
likewise,
courage is contagious, right? Isn't that what Julian
said? Exactly. Yeah. Totally true.
As always, I would like to thank Mick Wallace and Claire Daly for the use of this material. And I would like to say a big thank you to the podcast Around the Empire. Keep on listening to TRP.